out. The difference between the two hypothetical universes could hardly be more fundamental in principle, even if it is not easy to test in practice. And it undermines the complacently seductive dictum that science must be completely silent about religion's central existence claim. The presence or absence of a creative superintelligence is unequivocally a scientific question, even if it is not in practice, or not yet, a decided one. So also is the truth or falsehood of every one of the miracle stories that religions rely upon to impress multitudes of the faithful. Did Jesus have a human father, or was his mother a virgin at the time of his birth? Whether or not there is enough surviving evidence to decide it, this is still a strictly scientific question, with a definite answer in principle, yes or no. Did Jesus raise Lazarus from the dead? Did he himself come alive again 3 days after being crucified? There is an answer to every such question, whether or not we can discover it in practice, and it is a strictly scientific answer. The methods we should use to settle the matter, in the unlikely event that relevant evidence ever became available, would be purely and entirely scientific methods. To dramatize the point, imagine by some remarkable set of circumstances that forensic archaeologists unearthed DNA evidence to show that Jesus really did lack a biological father. Can you imagine religious apologists shrugging their shoulders and saying anything remotely like the following?
Who cares? Scientific evidence is completely irrelevant to theological questions. Wrong magisterium. We're concerned only with ultimate questions and with moral values. Neither DNA nor any other scientific evidence could ever have any bearing on the matter one way or the other.
The very idea is a joke. You can bet your boots that the scientific evidence, if any were to turn up, would be seized upon and trumpeted to the skies. Noma is popular only because there is no evidence to favour the God hypothesis. The moment there was the smallest suggestion of any evidence in favour of religious belief, religious apologists would lose no time in throwing Noma out of the window. Sophisticated theologians aside, and even they are happy to tell miracle stories to the unsophisticated in order to swell congregations, I suspect that alleged miracles provide the strongest reason many believers have for their faith, and miracles, by definition, violate the principles of science. The Roman Catholic Church, on the one hand, seems sometimes to aspire to Noma, but on the other hand, lays down the performance of miracles as an essential qualification for elevation to sainthood. The late King of the Belgians is a candidate for sainthood because of his stand on abortion. Earnest investigations are now going on to discover whether any miraculous cures can be attributed to prayers offered up to him since his death. I am not joking. That is the case. And it is typical of saint stories. I imagine the whole business is an embarrassment to more sophisticated circles within the church. Why any circles worthy of the name of sophisticated remain within the church is a mystery at least as deep as those that theologians enjoy.
When faced with miracle stories, Gould would presumably retort along the following lines. The whole point of Noma is that it is a two-way bargain. The moment religion steps on science's turf and starts to meddle in the real world with miracles, it ceases to be religion in the sense Gould is defending, and his amicabilis concordia is broken. Note, however, that the miracle-free religion defended by Gould would not be recognized by most practicing theists in the pew or on the prayer mat. It would indeed be a grave disappointment to them. To adapt Alice's comment on her sister's book before she fell into Wonderland, what is the use of a God who does no miracles and answers no prayers? Remember Ambrose Bierce's witty definition of the verb to pray?
To ask that the laws of the universe be annulled in behalf of a single petitioner, confessedly unworthy.
There are athletes who believe God helps them win, against opponents who would seem, on the face of it, no less worthy of his favouritism. There are motorists who believe God saves them a parking space, thereby presumably depriving somebody else. This style of theism is embarrassingly popular and is unlikely to be impressed by anything as, superficially, reasonable as Noma. Nevertheless, let us follow Gould and pare our religion down to some sort of non-interventionist minimum. No miracles, no personal communication between God and us in either direction, no monkeying with the laws of physics, no trespassing on the scientific grass. At most, a little deistic input to the initial conditions of the universe so that, in the fullness of time, stars, elements, chemistry, and planets develop, and life evolves. Surely that is an adequate separation. Surely Noma can survive this more modest and unassuming religion.
Well, you might think so. But I suggest that even a non-interventionist Noma god, though less violent and clumsy than an Abrahamic god, is still, when you look at him fair and square, a scientific hypothesis. I return to the point. A universe in which we are alone except for other slowly evolved intelligences is a very different universe from one with an original guiding agent whose intelligent design is responsible for its very existence. I accept that it may not be so easy in practice to distinguish one kind of universe from the other. Nevertheless, there is something utterly special about the hypothesis of ultimate design and equally special about the only known alternative, gradual evolution in the broad sense. They are close to being irreconcilably different. Like nothing else, evolution really does provide an explanation for the existence of entities whose improbability would otherwise, for practical purposes, rule them out. And the conclusion to the argument, as I shall show in Chapter 4, is close to being terminally fatal to the God hypothesis.
The Great Prayer Experiment. An amusing, if rather pathetic, case study in miracles is the Great Prayer Experiment. Does praying for patients help them recover? Prayers are commonly offered for sick people, both privately and in formal places of worship. Darwin's cousin, Francis Galton, was the first to analyse scientifically whether praying for people is efficacious. He noted that every Sunday in churches throughout Britain, entire congregations prayed publicly for the health of the royal family. Shouldn't they, therefore, be unusually fit, compared with the rest of us, who are prayed for only by our nearest and dearest? Galton looked into it and found no statistical difference. His intention may, in any case, have been satirical, as also when he prayed over randomised plots of land to see if the plants would grow any faster. They didn't. More recently, the physicist Russell Stannard, one of Britain's three well-known religious scientists, as we shall see, has thrown his weight behind an initiative funded by, of course, the Templeton Foundation, to test experimentally the proposition that praying for sick patients improves their health.
Such experiments, if done properly, have to be double-blind, and this standard was strictly observed. The patients were assigned, strictly at random, to an experimental group, received prayers, or a control group, received no prayers. Neither the patients, nor their doctors or caregivers, nor the experimenters were allowed to know which patients were being prayed for and which patients were controls. Those who did the experimental praying had to know the names of the individuals for whom they were praying, otherwise in what sense would they be praying for them rather than for somebody else. But care was taken to tell them only the first name and initial letter of the surname. Apparently that would be enough to enable God to pinpoint the right hospital bed. The very idea of doing such experiments is open to a generous measure of ridicule, and the project duly received it. As far as I know, Bob Newhart didn't do a sketch about it, but I can distinctly hear his voice.
"What's that you say, Lord? You can't cure me because I'm a member of the control group? Oh, I see, my aunt's prayers aren't enough, but, Lord, Mr. Evans in the next door bed... What was that, Lord? Mr. Evans received 1,000 prayers per day? But, Lord, Mr. Evans doesn't know 1,000 people. Oh, they just referred to him as John E. But, Lord, how did you know they didn't mean John Ellsworthy? Oh, right, you used your omniscience to work out which John E. they meant. But, Lord..."
Valiantly shouldering aside all mockery, the team of researchers soldiered on, spending $2.4 million of Templeton money under the leadership of Dr. Herbert Benson, a cardiologist at the Mind-Body Medical Institute near Boston. Dr. Benson was earlier quoted in a Templeton press release as believing that evidence for the efficacy of intercessory prayer in medicinal settings is mounting. Reassuringly, then, the research was in good hands, unlikely to be spoiled by skeptical vibrations. Dr. Benson and his team monitored 1,802 patients at six hospitals, all of whom received coronary bypass surgery. The patients were divided into three groups. Group 1 received prayers and didn't know it. Group 2, the control group, received no prayers and didn't know it. Group 3 received prayers and did know it. The comparison between groups 1 and 2 tests for the efficacy of intercessory prayer. Group 3 tests for possible psychosomatic effects of knowing that one is being prayed for.
Prayers were delivered by the congregations of three churches, one in Minnesota, one in Massachusetts, and one in Missouri, all distant from the three hospitals. The praying individuals, as explained, were given only the first name and initial letter of the surname of each patient for whom they were to pray. It is good experimental practice to standardize as far as possible, and they were all, accordingly, told to include in their prayers the phrase, "For a successful surgery with a quick, healthy recovery and no complications." The results, reported in the American Heart Journal of April 2006, were clear-cut. There was no difference between those patients who were prayed for and those who were not. What a surprise. There was a difference between those who knew they'd been prayed for and those who did not know one way or the other. But it went in the wrong direction. Those who knew they had been the beneficiaries of prayer suffered significantly more complications than those who did not. Was God doing a bit of smiting to show his disapproval of the whole balmy enterprise? It seems more probable that those patients who knew they were being prayed for suffered additional stress in consequence. Performance anxiety, as the experimenters put it. Dr. Charles Bethea, one of the researchers, said, "It may have made them uncertain, wondering, am I so sick they had to call in their prayer team?" In today's litigious society, is it too much to hope that those patients suffering heart complications, as a consequence of knowing they were receiving experimental prayers, might put together a class action lawsuit against the Templeton Foundation?
It will be no surprise that this study was opposed by theologians, perhaps anxious about its capacity to bring ridicule upon religion. The Oxford theologian Richard Swinburne, writing after the study failed, objected to it on the grounds that God answers prayers only if they are offered up for good reasons. Praying for somebody rather than somebody else, simply because of the fall of the dice in the design of a double-blind experiment, does not constitute a good reason. God would see through it. That indeed was the point of my Bob Newhart satire, and Swinburne is right to make it too. But in other parts of his paper, Swinburne himself is beyond satire. Not for the first time, he seeks to justify suffering in a world run by God.
My suffering provides me with the opportunity to show courage and patience. It provides you with the opportunity to show sympathy and to help alleviate my suffering. And it provides society with the opportunity to choose whether or not to invest a lot of money in trying to find a cure for this or that particular kind of suffering. Although a good God regrets our suffering, his greatest concern is surely that each of us shall show patience, sympathy and generosity and, thereby, form a holy character. Some people badly need to be ill for their own sake, and some people badly need to be ill to provide important choices for others. Only in that way can some people be encouraged to make serious choices about the sort of person they are to be. For other people, illness is not so valuable.
This grotesque piece of reasoning, so damningly typical of the theological mind, reminds me of an occasion when I was on a television panel with Swinburne, and also with our Oxford colleague, Professor Peter Atkins. Swinburne, at one point, attempted to justify the Holocaust, on the grounds that it gave the Jews a wonderful opportunity to be courageous and noble. Peter Atkins splendidly growled, "May you rot in hell!"
Another typical piece of theological reasoning occurs further along in Swinburne's article. He rightly suggests that if God wanted to demonstrate his own existence, he would find better ways to do it than slightly biasing the recovery statistics of experimental versus control groups of heart patients. If God existed and wanted to convince us of it, he would fill the world with super miracles. But then Swinburne lets fall his gem.
There is quite a lot of evidence anyway of God's existence, and too much might not be good for us.
Too much might not be good for us. Read it again. Too much evidence might not be good for us. Richard Swinburne is the recently retired holder of one of Britain's most prestigious professorships of theology and is a fellow of the British Academy. If it's a theologian you want, they don't come much more distinguished. Perhaps you don't want a theologian.
Swinburne wasn't the only theologian to disown the study after it had failed. The Reverend Raymond J. Lawrence was granted a generous tranche of op-ed space in the New York Times to explain why responsible religious leaders will breathe a sigh of relief that no evidence could be found of intercessory prayer having any effect. Would he have sung a different tune if the Benson study had succeeded in demonstrating the power of prayer? Maybe not, but you can be certain that plenty of other pastors and theologians would. The Reverend Lawrence's piece is chiefly memorable for the following revelation.
Recently, a colleague told me about a devout, well-educated woman who accused a doctor of malpractice in his treatment of her husband. During her husband's dying days, she charged, the doctor had failed to pray for him.
Other theologians joined Noma-inspired skeptics in contending that studying prayer in this way is a waste of money because supernatural influences are by definition beyond the reach of science. But, as the Templeton Foundation correctly recognized when it financed the study, the alleged power of intercessory prayer is, at least in principle, within the reach of science. A double-blind experiment can be done and was done. It could have yielded a positive result. And if it had, can you imagine that a single religious apologist would have dismissed it on the grounds that scientific research has no bearing on religious matters? Of course not. Needless to say, the negative results of the experiment will not shake the faithful. Bob Barth, the spiritual director of the Missouri Prayer Ministry, which supplies some of the experimental prayers, said,
a person of faith would say that this study is interesting, but we've been praying a long time, and we've seen prayer work. We know it works, and the research on prayer and spirituality is just getting started.
Yeah, right. We know from our faith that prayer works. So if evidence fails to show it, we'll just soldier on until finally we get the result we want. The Neville Chamberlain School of Evolutionists. A possible ulterior motive for those scientists who insist on Noma, the invulnerability to science of the God hypothesis, is a peculiarly American political agenda provoked by the threat of populist creationism. In parts of the United States, science is under attack from a well-organized, politically well-connected, and above all well-financed, opposition, and the teaching of evolution is in the front-line trench. Scientists could be forgiven for feeling threatened, because most research money comes ultimately from government, and elected representatives have to answer to the ignorant and prejudiced, as well as to the well-informed among their constituents. In response to such threats, an evolution defense lobby has sprung up, most notably represented by the National Center for Science Education, NCSE, led by Eugenie Scott, indefatigable activist on behalf of science, who has recently produced her own book, Evolution versus Creationism. One of NCSE's main political objectives is to court and mobilize sensible religious opinion, mainstream churchmen and women who have no problem with evolution and may regard it as irrelevant to, or even in some strange way supportive of, their faith. It is to this mainstream of clergy, theologians, and non-fundamentalist believers, embarrassed as they are by creationism because it brings religion into disrepute, that the evolution defense lobby tries to appeal. And one way to do this is to bend over backwards in their direction by espousing Noma, agree that science is completely non-threatening because it is disconnected from religion's claims. Another prominent luminary of what we might call the Neville Chamberlain School of Evolutionists is the philosopher Michael Ruse. Ruse has been an effective campaigner against creationism, both on paper and in court. He claims to be an atheist, but his article in Playboy takes the view that
we who love science must realize that the enemy of our enemies is our friend. Too often evolutionists spend time insulting would-be allies. This is especially true of secular evolutionists. Atheists spend more time running down sympathetic Christians than they do countering creationists. When John Paul II wrote a letter endorsing Darwinism, Richard Dawkins' response was simply that the Pope was a hypocrite, that he could not be genuine about science, and that Dawkins himself simply preferred an honest fundamentalist.
From a purely tactical viewpoint, I can see the superficial appeal of Roos's comparison with the fight against Hitler.
Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt did not like Stalin and communism, but in fighting Hitler, they realized that they had to work with the Soviet Union. Evolutionists of all kinds must likewise work together to fight creationism.
But I finally come down on the side of my colleague, the Chicago geneticist Jerry Coyne, who wrote that Roos
fails to grasp the real nature of the conflict. It's not just about evolution versus creationism. To scientists like Dawkins and Wilson, E.O. Wilson, the celebrated Harvard biologist, the real war is between rationalism and superstition. Science is but one form of rationalism, while religion is the most common form of superstition. Creationism is just a symptom of what they see as the greater enemy, religion. While religion can exist without creationism, creationism cannot exist without religion.
I do have one thing in common with the creationists. Like me, but unlike the Chamberlain School, they will have no truck with Noma and its separate magisteria. Far from respecting the separateness of science's turf, creationists like nothing better than to trample their dirty hobnails all over it. And they fight dirty too. Lawyers for creationists in court cases around the American boondocks seek out evolutionists who are openly atheists. I know, to my chagrin, that my name has been used in this way. It is an effective tactic because juries selected at random are likely to include individuals brought up to believe that atheists are demons incarnate, on a par with paedophiles or terrorists, today's equivalent of Salem's witches and McCarthy's commies. Any creationist lawyer who got me on the stand could instantly win over the jury simply by asking me, "Has your knowledge of evolution influenced you in the direction of becoming an atheist?" I would have to answer yes, and at one stroke I would have lost the jury. By contrast, the judicially correct answer from the secularist side would be, "My religious beliefs or lack of them are a private matter, neither the business of this court nor connected in any way with my science." I couldn't honestly say this, for reasons I shall explain in Chapter 4. The Guardian journalist Madeline Bunting wrote an article entitled "Why the Intelligent Design Lobby Thanks God for Richard Dawkins." There's no indication that she consulted anybody except Michael Roos, and her article might as well have been ghostwritten by him. Dan Dennett replied, aptly quoting Uncle Remus,
"I find it amusing that two Brits, Madeline Bunting and Michael Roos, have fallen for a version of one of the most famous scams in American folklore, Why the Intelligent Design Lobby Thanks God for Richard Dawkins, March 27th. When Br'er Rabbit gets caught by the fox, he pleads with him, "Oh, please, please, Br'er Fox, whatever you do, don't throw me in that awful briar patch," where he ends up safe and sound after the fox does just that. When the American propagandist William Dembski writes tauntingly to Richard Dawkins, telling him to keep up the good work on behalf of intelligent design, Bunting and Roos fall for it. "Oh, golly, Br'er Fox, your forthright assertion that evolutionary biology disproves the idea of a creator god jeopardizes the teaching of biology in science class, since teaching that would violate the separation of church and state." Right. You also ought to soft-pedal physiology, since it declares virgin birth impossible.
This whole issue, including an independent invocation of Br'er Rabbit in the briar patch, is well discussed by the biologist P.Z. Myers, whose pharyngular blog can reliably be consulted for trenchant good sense. I'm not suggesting that my colleagues of the appeasement lobby are necessarily dishonest. They may sincerely believe in Noma, although I can't help wondering how thoroughly they've thought it through and how they reconcile the internal conflicts in their minds. There's no need to pursue the matter for the moment, but anyone seeking to understand the published statements of scientists on religious matters would do well not to forget the political context, the surreal culture wars now rending America. Noma-style appeasement will surface again in a later chapter. Here, I return to agnosticism and the possibility of chipping away at our ignorance and measurably reducing our uncertainty about the existence or non-existence of God.
Little Green Men. Suppose Bertrand Russell's parable had concerned not a teapot in outer space, but life in outer space, the subject of Sagan's memorable refusal to think with his gut. Once again, we cannot disprove it, and the only strictly rational stance is agnosticism. But the hypothesis is no longer frivolous. We don't immediately scent extreme improbability. We can have an interesting argument based on incomplete evidence, and we can write down the kind of evidence that would decrease our uncertainty. We'd be outraged if our government invested in expensive telescopes for the sole purpose of searching for orbiting teapots. But we can appreciate the case for spending money on SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, using radio telescopes to scan the skies in the hope of picking up signals from intelligent aliens.
I praised Carl Sagan for disavowing gut feelings about alien life. But one can, and Sagan did, make a sober assessment of what we would need to know in order to estimate the probability. This might start from nothing more than a listing of our points of ignorance, as in the famous Drake equation, which, in Paul Davies's phrase, collects probabilities. It states that to estimate the number of independently evolved civilizations in the universe, you must multiply 7 terms together. The 7 include the number of stars, the number of Earth-like planets per star, and the probability of this, that, and the other, which I need not list, because the only point I'm making is that they are all unknown, or estimated with enormous margins of error. When so many terms that are either completely or almost completely unknown are multiplied up, the product, the estimated number of alien civilizations, has such colossal error bars that agnosticism seems a very reasonable, if not the only credible, stance.
Some of the terms in the Drake equation are already less unknown than when he first wrote it down in 1961. At that time, our solar system of planets orbiting a central star was the only one known, together with the local analogies provided by Jupiter's and Saturn's satellite systems. Our best estimate of the number of orbiting systems in the universe was based on theoretical models coupled with the more informal principle of mediocrity, the feeling, born of uncomfortable history lessons from Copernicus, Hubble, and others, that there should be nothing particularly unusual about the place where we happen to live. Unfortunately, the principle of mediocrity is in its turn emasculated by the anthropic principle, see Chapter 4. If our solar system really were the only one in the universe, this is precisely where we, as beings who think about such matters, would have to be living. The very fact of our existence could retrospectively determine that we live in an extremely unmediocre place. But today's estimates of the ubiquity of solar systems are no longer based on the principle of mediocrity. They are informed by direct evidence. The spectroscope, nemesis of Kant's positivism, strikes again. Our telescopes are scarcely powerful enough to see planets around other stars directly. But the position of a star is perturbed by the gravitational pull of its planets as they whirl around it, and spectroscopes can pick up the Doppler shifts in the star's spectrum, at least in cases where the perturbing planet is large. Mostly using this method, at the time of writing, we now know of 170 extrasolar planets orbiting 147 stars. But the figure will certainly have increased by the time you read this book. So far, they are bulky Jupiters, because only Jupiters are large enough to perturb their stars into the zone of detectability of present-day spectroscopes.
We have at least quantitatively improved our estimate of one previously shrouded term of the Drake equation. This permits a significant, if still moderate, easing of our agnosticism about the final value yielded by the equation. We must still be agnostic about life on other worlds, but a little bit less agnostic, because we are just that bit less ignorant. Science can chip away at agnosticism in a way that Huxley bent over backwards to deny for the special case of God. I am arguing that, notwithstanding the polite abstinence of Huxley, Gould, and many others, the God question is not in principle and forever outside the remit of science. As with the nature of the stars, contra Kant, and as with the likelihood of life in orbit around them, science can make at least probabilistic inroads into the territory of agnosticism. My definition of the God hypothesis included the words superhuman and supernatural. To clarify the difference, imagine that a SETI radio telescope actually did pick up a signal from outer space which showed unequivocally that we are not alone. It is a non-trivial question, by the way, what kind of signal would convince us of its intelligent origin. A good approach is to turn the question around. What should we intelligently do in order to advertise our presence to extraterrestrial listeners? Rhythmic pulses wouldn't do it. Jocelyn Bell Burnell, the radio astronomer who first discovered the pulsar in 1967, was moved by the precision of its 1.33-second periodicity to name it, tongue-in-cheek, the LGM, Little Green Men, signal. She later found a second pulsar elsewhere in the sky and of different periodicity, which pretty much disposed of the LGM hypothesis. Metronomic rhythms can be generated by many non-intelligent phenomena, from swaying branches to dripping water, from time lags in self-regulating feedback loops, to spinning and orbiting celestial bodies. More than 1,000 pulsars have now been found in our galaxy, and it is generally accepted that each one is a spinning neutron star, emitting radio energy that sweeps around like a lighthouse beam. It is amazing to think of a star rotating on a timescale of seconds. Imagine if each of our days lasted 1.33 seconds instead of 24 hours. But just about everything we know of neutron stars is amazing. The point is that the pulsar phenomenon is now understood as a product of simple physics, not intelligence.
Nothing simply rhythmic, then, would announce our intelligent presence to the waiting universe. Prime numbers are often mentioned as the recipe of choice, since it is difficult to think of a purely physical process that could generate them. Whether by detecting prime numbers or by some other means, imagine that SETI does come up with unequivocal evidence of extraterrestrial intelligence, followed, perhaps, by a massive transmission of knowledge and wisdom along the science fiction lines of Fred Hoyle's A for Andromeda or Carl Sagan's Contact. How should we respond? A pardonable reaction would be something akin to worship, for any civilization capable of broadcasting a signal over such an immense distance is likely to be greatly superior to ours. Even if that civilization is not more advanced than ours at the time of transmission, the enormous distance between us entitles us to calculate that they must be millennia ahead of us by the time the message reaches us, unless they've driven themselves extinct, which is not unlikely. Whether we ever get to know about them or not, there are very probably alien civilizations that are superhuman to the point of being godlike in ways that exceed anything a theologian could possibly imagine. Their technical achievements would seem as supernatural to us as ours would seem to a Dark Age peasant transported to the 21st century. Imagine his response to a laptop computer, a mobile telephone, a hydrogen bomb or a jumbo jet. As Arthur C. Clarke put it in his Third Law,
any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
The miracles wrought by our technology would have seemed to the ancients no less remarkable than the tales of Moses parting the waters or Jesus walking upon them. The aliens of our SETI signal would be to us like gods, just as missionaries were treated as gods and exploited the undeserved honour to the hilt when they turned up in Stone Age cultures bearing guns, telescopes, matches, and almanacs predicting eclipses to the second.
In what sense, then, would the most advanced SETI aliens not be gods? In what sense would they be superhuman but not supernatural? In a very important sense, which goes to the heart of this book. The crucial difference between gods and godlike extraterrestrials lies not in their properties, but in their provenance. Entities that are complex enough to be intelligent are products of an evolutionary process. No matter how godlike they may seem when we encounter them, they didn't start that way. Science fiction authors such as Daniel F. Galloy in Counterfeit World have even suggested, and I cannot think how to disprove it, that we live in a computer simulation set up by some vastly superior civilization. But the simulators themselves would have to come from somewhere. the laws of probability forbid all notions of their spontaneously appearing without simpler antecedents. They probably owe their existence to a, perhaps unfamiliar, version of Darwinian evolution, some sort of cumulatively ratcheting crane as opposed to skyhook, to use Daniel Dennett's terminology. Skyhooks, including all gods, are magic spells. They do no bona fide explanatory work, and demand more explanation than they provide. Cranes are explanatory devices that actually do explain. Natural selection is the champion crane of all time. It has lifted life from primeval simplicity to the dizzy heights of complexity, beauty, and apparent design that dazzle us today. This will be a dominant theme of Chapter 4, why there almost certainly is no God. But first, before proceeding with my main reason for actively disbelieving in God's existence, I have a responsibility to dispose of the positive arguments for belief that have been offered through history. Chapter 3. Arguments for God's Existence.
A professorship of theology should have no place in our institution. Thomas Jefferson.
Arguments for the existence of God have been codified for centuries by theologians and supplemented by others, including purveyors of misconceived common sense. Thomas Aquinas's proofs. The five proofs asserted by Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century don't prove anything and are easily, though I hesitate to say so given his eminence, exposed as vacuous. The first three are just different ways of saying the same thing, and they can be considered together. All involve an infinite regress. The answer to a question raises a prior question, and so on ad infinitum.
1. The unmoved mover. Nothing moves without a prior mover. This leads us to a regress from which the only escape is God. Something had to make the first move, and that something we call God. 2. The uncaused cause. Nothing is caused by itself. Every effect has a prior cause, and again we are pushed back into regress. This has to be terminated by a first cause, which we call God. 3. The cosmological argument. There must have been a time when no physical things existed, but since physical things exist now, there must have been something non-physical to bring them into existence, and that something we call God.
All three of these arguments rely upon the idea of a regress and invoke God to terminate it. They make the entirely unwarranted assumption that God himself is immune to the regress. Even if we allow the dubious luxury of arbitrarily conjuring up a terminator to an infinite regress and giving it a name, simply because we need one, there is absolutely no reason to endow that terminator with any of the properties normally ascribed to God: omnipotence, omniscience, goodness, creativity of design, to say nothing of such human attributes as listening to prayers, forgiving sins, and reading innermost thoughts. Incidentally, it has not escaped the notice of logicians that omniscience and omnipotence are mutually incompatible. If God is omniscient, he must already know how he is going to intervene to change the course of history using his omnipotence. But that means he can't change his mind about his intervention, which means he is not omnipotent. Karen Owens has captured this witty little paradox in equally engaging verse.
Can omniscient God, who knows the future, find the omnipotence to change his future mind?
To return to the infinite regress and the futility of invoking God to terminate it, it is more parsimonious to conjure up, say, a Big Bang singularity or some other physical concept as yet unknown. Calling it God is at best unhelpful and at worst perniciously misleading. Edward Lear's nonsense recipe for crumboblious cutlets invites us to
procure some strips of beef, and having cut them into the smallest possible pieces, proceed to cut them still smaller, 8 or perhaps 9 times.
Some regresses do reach a natural terminator. Scientists used to wonder what would happen if you could dissect, say, gold, into the smallest possible pieces. Why shouldn't you cut one of those pieces in half and produce an even smaller smidgen of gold? The regress in this case is decisively terminated by the atom. The smallest possible piece of gold is a nucleus consisting of exactly 79 protons and a slightly larger number of neutrons, attended by a swarm of 79 electrons. If you cut gold any further than the level of the single atom, whatever else you get, it is not gold. The atom provides a natural terminator to the Crumbobius cutlets type of regress. It is by no means clear that God provides a natural terminator to the regresses of Aquinas. That's putting it mildly, as we shall see later. Let's move on down Aquinas's list.
4. The argument from degree. We notice that things in the world differ. There are degrees of, say, goodness or perfection. But we judge these degrees only by comparison with a maximum. Humans can be both good and bad, so the maximum goodness cannot rest in us. Therefore, there must be some other maximum to set the standard for perfection, and we call that maximum God.
That's an argument. You might as well say people vary in smelliness, but we can make the comparison only by reference to a perfect maximum of conceivable smelliness. Therefore, there must exist a preeminently peerless stinker, and we call him God. Or substitute any dimension of comparison you like, and derive an equally fatuous conclusion.
5. The teleological argument, or argument from design. Things in the world, especially living things, look as though they have been designed. Nothing we know looks designed unless it is designed. Therefore, there must have been a designer, and we call him God.
Aquinas himself used the analogy of an arrow moving towards a target, but a modern heat-seeking anti-aircraft missile would have suited his purpose better. The argument from design is the only one still in regular use today, and it still sounds to many like the ultimate knock-down argument. The young Darwin was impressed by it when, as a Cambridge undergraduate, he read it in William Paley's Natural Theology. Unfortunately for Paley, the mature Darwin blew it out of the water. There has probably never been a more devastating rout of popular belief by clever reasoning than Charles Darwin's destruction of the argument from design. It was so unexpected. Thanks to Darwin, it is no longer true to say that nothing that we know looks designed unless it is designed. Evolution by natural selection produces an excellent simulacrum of design, mounting prodigious heights of complexity and elegance. And among these eminence of pseudo-design are nervous systems which, among their more modest accomplishments, manifest goal-seeking behavior that, even in a tiny insect, resembles a sophisticated heat-seeking missile more than a simple arrow on target. I shall return to the argument from design in Chapter 4. The ontological argument and other a priori arguments. Arguments for God's existence fall into two main categories, the a priori and the a posteriori. Thomas Aquinas's 5 are a posteriori arguments, relying upon inspection of the world. The most famous of the a priori arguments, those that rely upon pure armchair ratiocination, is the ontological argument, proposed by St. Anselm of Canterbury in 1078 and restated in different forms by numerous philosophers ever since. An odd aspect of Anselm's argument is that it was originally addressed not to humans but to God himself in the form of a prayer. You'd think that any entity capable of listening to a prayer would need no convincing of his own existence. It is possible to conceive, Anselm said, of a being than which nothing greater can be conceived. Even an atheist can conceive of such a superlative being, though he would deny its existence in the real world. But, goes the argument, a being that doesn't exist in the real world is, by that very fact, less than perfect. Therefore we have a contradiction, and hey presto, God exists. Let me translate this infantile argument into the appropriate language, which is the language of the playground.
Bet you I can prove God exists.
Bet you can't.
Right then, imagine the most perfect, perfect, perfect thing possible.
Okay, now what?
Now, is that perfect, perfect, perfect thing real? Does it exist?
No, it's only in my mind.
But if it was real, it would be even more perfect, because a really, really perfect thing would have to be better than a silly old imaginary thing. So I've proved that God exists. Na 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 na. All atheists are fools.
I had my childish wiseacre choose the word fools advisedly. Anselm himself quoted the first verse of Psalm 14. The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. And he had the cheek to use the name fool, Latin incipiens, for his hypothetical atheist.
Hence, even the fool is convinced that something exists in the understanding, at least, than which nothing greater can be conceived. For when he hears of this, he understands it. And whatever is understood exists in the understanding. And assuredly that, than which nothing greater can be conceived, cannot exist in the understanding alone. For suppose it exists in the understanding alone, then it can be conceived to exist in reality, which is greater.
The very idea that grand conclusions could follow from such logomachist trickery offends me aesthetically, so I must take care to refrain from bandying words like fool. Bertrand Russell, no fool, interestingly said,
"It is easier to feel convinced that the ontological argument must be fallacious than it is to find out precisely where the fallacy lies."
Russell himself, as a young man, was briefly convinced by it.
"I remember the precise moment, one day in 1894, as I was walking along Trinity Lane, when I saw in a flash, or thought I saw, that the ontological argument is valid. I'd gone out to buy a tin of tobacco. On my way back, I suddenly threw it up in the air and exclaimed as I caught it, 'Great Scott! The ontological argument is sound!'"
Why, I wonder, didn't he say something like,
"Great Scott! The ontological argument seems to be plausible. But isn't it too good to be true that a grand truth about the cosmos should follow from a mere word game? I'd better set to work to resolve what is perhaps a paradox like those of Zeno."
The Greeks had a hard time seeing through Zeno's proof that Achilles would never catch the tortoise.
"Achilles can run 10 times as fast as the tortoise, so he gives the animal, say, 100 yards start. Achilles runs 100 yards and the tortoise is now 10 yards ahead. Achilles runs the 10 yards and the tortoise is now 1 yard ahead. Achilles runs the 1 yard and the tortoise is still 1/10 of a yard ahead. And so on ad infinitum, so Achilles never catches the tortoise."
But the Greeks had the sense not to conclude that therefore Achilles really would fail to catch the tortoise. Instead, they called it a paradox, and waited for later generations of mathematicians to explain it, with, as it turned out, the theory of infinite series converging on a limiting value. Russell himself, of course, was as well qualified as anyone to understand why no tobacco tins should be thrown up in celebration of Achilles' failure to catch the tortoise. Why didn't he exercise the same caution over St. Anselm? I suspect that he was an exaggeratedly fair-minded atheist, over-eager to be disillusioned if logic seemed to require it. Or perhaps the answer lies in something Russell himself wrote in 1946, long after he had rumbled the ontological argument.
"The real question is there anything we can think of which, by the mere fact that we can think of it, is shown to exist outside our thought? Every philosopher would like to say yes, because a philosopher's job is to find out things about the world by thinking rather than observing. If yes is the right answer, there is a bridge from pure thought to things. If not, not."
My own feeling to the contrary would have been an automatic deep suspicion of any line of reasoning that reached such a significant conclusion without feeding in a single piece of data from the real world. Perhaps that indicates no more than that I am a scientist rather than a philosopher. Philosophers down the centuries have indeed taken the ontological argument seriously, both for and against. The atheist philosopher J.L. Mackey gives a particularly clear discussion in The Miracle of Theism. I mean it as a compliment when I say that you could almost define a philosopher as someone who won't take common sense for an answer. The most definitive refutations of the ontological argument are usually attributed to the philosophers David Hume, 1711-76, and Immanuel Kant, 1724-1804. Kant identified the trick card up Anselm's sleeve as his slippery assumption that existence is more perfect than non-existence. The American philosopher Norman Malcolm put it like this.
The doctrine that existence is a perfection is remarkably queer. It makes sense and is true to say that my future house will be a better one if it is insulated than if it is not insulated, but what could it mean to say that it will be a better house if it exists than if it does not?
Another philosopher, the Australian Douglas Gasking, made the point with his ironic proof that God does not exist. Anselm's contemporary Gornilo had suggested a somewhat similar reductio.
1. The creation of the world is the most marvellous achievement imaginable. 2. The merit of an achievement is the product of A, its intrinsic quality, and B, the ability of its creator. 3. The greater the disability or handicap of the creator, the more impressive the achievement. 4. The most formidable handicap for a creator would be non-existence. 5. Therefore, if we suppose that the universe is the product of an existent creator, we can conceive a greater being, namely, one who created everything while not existing. 6. An existing God, therefore, would not be a being greater than which a greater cannot be conceived, because an even more formidable and incredible creator would be a God which did not exist. Ergo, 7. God does not exist.
Needless to say, Gasking didn't really prove that God does not exist. By the same token, Anselm didn't prove that he does. The only difference is, Gasking was being funny on purpose. As he realized, the existence or non-existence of God is too big a question to be decided by dialectical prestidigitation. And I don't think the slippery use of existence as an indicator of perfection is the worst of the argument's problems. I've forgotten the details, but I once piqued a gathering of theologians and philosophers by adapting the ontological argument to prove that pigs can fly. They felt the need to resort to modal logic to prove that I was wrong. The ontological argument, like all a priori arguments for the existence of God, reminds me of the old man in Aldous Huxley's Point Counterpoint, who discovered a mathematical proof of the existence of God.
You know the formula m over naught equals infinity, m being any positive number? Well, why not reduce the equation to a simpler form by multiplying both sides by naught, in which case you have m equals infinity times naught. That is to say that a positive number is the product of zero and infinity. Doesn't that demonstrate the creation of the universe by an infinite power out of nothing? Doesn't it?
Or there is the notorious 18th century debate on the existence of God, staged by Catherine the Great, between Euler, the Swiss mathematician, and Diderot, the great encyclopedist of the Enlightenment. The pious Euler advanced upon the atheistic Diderot, and in tones of the utmost conviction delivered his challenge. Monsieur, A plus B to the N over N equals X. Therefore God exists. Reply! Diderot was cowed into withdrawal, and one version of the story has him withdrawing all the way back to France. Euler was employing what might be called the argument from blinding with science, in this case mathematics. David Mills, in Atheist Universe, transcribed a radio interview of himself by a religious spokesman who invoked the law of conservation of mass energy in a weirdly ineffectual attempt to blind with science.
Since we're all composed of matter and energy, doesn't that scientific principle lend credibility to a belief in eternal life?
Mills replied more patiently and politely than I would have, for what the interviewer was saying, translated into English, was no more than, when we die, none of the atoms of our body and none of the energy are lost. Therefore we are immortal. Even I, with my long experience, have never encountered wishful thinking as silly as that. I have, however, met many of the wonderful proofs collected at the richly comic web page of over 300 proofs of God's existence. Here's a hilarious half dozen, beginning with proof number 36. Argument from incomplete devastation. A plane crashed, killing 143 passengers and crew, but one child survived with only third-degree burns, therefore God exists.
37. Argument from possible worlds. If things had been different, then things would be different. That would be bad. Therefore God exists.
38. argument from sheer will. I do believe in God. I do believe in God. I do, I do, I do, I do believe in God. Therefore God exists.
39. Argument from non-belief. The majority of the world's population are non-believers in Christianity. This is just what Satan intended. Therefore God exists.
40. Argument from post-death experience. Person X died an atheist. He now realizes his mistake. Therefore God exists.
41. Argument from emotional blackmail. God loves you. How could you be so heartless as not to believe in him? Therefore God exists.
The argument from beauty. Another character in the Aldous Huxley novel just mentioned proved the existence of God by playing Beethoven's string quartet number 15 in A minor, Heiliger Dankgesang, on a gramophone. Unconvincing as that sounds, it does represent a popular strand of argument. I've given up counting the number of times I receive the more or less truculent challenge, "How do you account for Shakespeare, then?" Substitute Schubert, Michelangelo, etc., to taste. The argument will be so familiar I needn't document it further, but the logic behind it is never spelled out, and the more you think about it, the more vacuous you realize it to be. Obviously, Beethoven's late quartets are sublime. So are Shakespeare's sonnets. They are sublime if God is there, and they are sublime if he isn't. They do not prove the existence of God, they prove the existence of Beethoven and of Shakespeare. A great conductor is credited with saying, "If you have Mozart to listen to, why would you need God?" I once was the guest of the week on the BBC radio show Desert Island Discs. You have to choose the 8 records you would take with you if marooned on a desert island. Among my choices was Mache dich mein Herze rein from Bach's St. Matthew Passion. The interviewer was unable to understand how I could choose religious music without being religious. You might as well say, how can you enjoy Wuthering Heights when you know perfectly well that Cathy and Heathcliff never really existed? But there is an additional point that I might have made, and which needs to be made whenever religion is given credit for, say, the Sistine Chapel or Raphael's Annunciation. Even great artists have to earn a living, and they will take commissions where they are to be had. I have no reason to doubt that Raphael and Michelangelo were Christians. It was pretty much the only option in their time. But the fact is almost incidental. Its enormous wealth had made the church the dominant patron of the arts. If history had worked out differently, and Michelangelo had been commissioned to paint a ceiling for a giant museum of science, mightn't he have produced something at least as inspirational as the Sistine Chapel? How sad that we shall never hear Beethoven's Mesozoic Symphony, or Mozart's opera The Expanding Universe. And what a shame that we are deprived of Haydn's Evolution Oratorio. But that does not stop us from enjoying his creation. To approach the argument from the other side, what if, as my wife chillingly suggests to me, Shakespeare had been obliged to work to commission from the church? We'd surely have lost Hamlet, King Lear, and Macbeth. And what would we have gained in return? Such stuff as dreams are made on? Dream on.
If there is a logical argument linking the existence of great art to the existence of God, it is not spelled out by its proponents. It's simply assumed to be self-evident, which it most certainly is not. Maybe it is to be seen as yet another version of the argument from design. Schubert's musical brain is a wonder of improbability, even more so than the vertebrate eye. Or, more ignobly, perhaps it's a sort of jealousy of genius. How dare another human being make such beautiful music, poetry, art, when I can't? It must be God that did it.
The argument from personal experience. One of the cleverer and more mature of my undergraduate contemporaries, who was deeply religious, went camping in the Scottish Isles. In the middle of the night, he and his girlfriend were woken in their tent by the voice of the devil, Satan himself. There could be no possible doubt. The voice was in every sense diabolical. My friend would never forget this horrifying experience, and it was one of the factors that later drove him to be ordained. My youthful self was impressed by his story, and I recounted it to a gathering of zoologists relaxing in the Rose and Crown Inn, Oxford. Two of them happened to be experienced ornithologists, and they roared with laughter. "Manx Shearwater," they shouted in delighted chorus. One of them added that the diabolical shrieks and cackles of this species have earned it, in various parts of the world and various languages,